Hey, how's it going? Welcome to Forensic Forecast. I'm Lee, and joining us also today, so far, is Brian. How you doing, Brian?
Hi, Lee. Doing pretty well. Thanks for having me again. Somehow, for some reason, I don't know why, you decided to have me back for a second episode, so kudos to you, sir.
Well, you know, no one else was available, so...
You have to go down the list, and I'm at the very bottom, so we know.
You're on the no list. We don't usually come to you. But you'll notice, everyone will notice that the OV Carroll picture is now gone. Alicia made me take it down because it was a little bit freaky. So what I've decided to do instead is this. Welcome to Cyberspeak. No. That sounds just like him too. That's a scary thing. So, what we want to do today is there's a couple of things we just want to cover. We've got one main topic that I want to get into. But before we do that, I just want to let everyone know what's going on. So, first of all, just 2 weeks ago, maybe a week and a half ago, the first issue of the Forensic Forecast magazine, or Formag, was released. You can find that on the Forensic Forecast website. And it's I know. There's a couple of people in there who I don't know if I would have let them write, to be honest, like Brian and Ken Johnson. But, you know, besides them, the articles are pretty good.
Yes.
Spent a long time getting this together. It's a year in the making. So even if you're not even that bothered about about magazines and everything else, just take a look at it, see what you think, and please provide some feedback because we want to make this good. We want to make it better, and we want it to basically be the de facto publication for digital forensics, much like Forensic Forecast is the de facto podcast. Don't listen to Cyberspeak anymore. It's gone really, really downhill since Brett left. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that nominations for the Forensic Forecast Awards have now finished, now closed. What we do have, though, is that we've counted all the nominations and we have now posted all of the nominees for your vote for the Forensic Forecast Awards 2013. And what I want to do is just go down some of these nominees and just talk about them, just a little bit of detail so people can know generally what these people are being nominated for. So, for Computer Forensic Software of the Year, we have Forensics Time, Internet Evidence Finder, and Volatility are the nominees for that. So, Forensics Time. Do you know about Forensics Time, Brian?
I haven't used it at all, to be honest with you.
Okay. I used it whenever... This is David Nides wrote this software. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's a plug-in for Log2Timeline. What it allows you to do is you run Log2Timeline, you take the body file from that, essentially take the body file, load it into Forensics Time. And Forensics Time manipulates this data and puts it in, gives you a graphical representation of the software, of the timeline. And you can see patterns occurring, you know, time of day that something happens on a regular basis. It's really, really cool tool to use, especially if you're trying to pinpoint specific things that the user has done. It's really quite helpful. I recommend people having a look at that. David offers it, as Kristen does with Log2Timeline, free of charge. Just Google Forensics Time, you'll find it easy enough. So, yeah, that's the first one. Internet Evidence Finder. How about that, Brian? You heard of that one?
Yeah, we use that one. Primarily use that as a triage tool for a couple of cases to get an initial look at some of the data and then dig deeper into it. I mean, it works really, really great for the stuff that it supports. I think they just released an update to support Mac, which it's going to be a huge difference going through 750 gigs sector by sector compared to actually getting the OS view. So, I mean, that's going to make it a little bit faster. But, yeah, like I said, it worked pretty well a couple of times we had to use it. So,
yeah, awesome. Now, I mean, so bearing in mind that this is just for stuff which happened in 2012, not for 2013. So the Mac stuff you'll have to vote for next year if I get nominated. But I mean, this tool is pretty good, and I've knocked this a lot recently because of the price hike and everything else that happened a couple of years ago. But in fairness and honesty, I mean, that they've added so many features to this, and it does so much. Especially the opportunity which you have to use the software to go back and look at internet and web-based evidence through volume shadow copies. I think that's really, really useful because a lot of people won't even look there typically. So, Internet Evidence Finder also very, very good. Volatility. Now, I personally have never used volatility before. Brian, I hope you have.
I use it all the time. it's pretty much the memory analysis tool / suite. I mean, they just, once again, it doesn't count for this year, but they just released a whole bunch of plugins for Mac. Once again, everybody's getting on the Mac bandwagon now. But, I mean, it's a powerful, powerful tool. And, I mean, you know, there's a couple of cases that we've used that specifically on, and that alone has pretty much solved the case for us. So it's awesome. And best of all, right now, it's free. Hopefully, fingers crossed, it always stays free.
I keep hearing about all these tools. It took me long enough to start using Log to Timeline. You know, I already started using that in the last year. I'm really, really sorry to say. But, you know, all these tools which people are coming out with, if you spend all your time looking at them and researching them, making sure they work right and everything else, that's something you'd never do. So you've got to really pick and choose your tools, unfortunately. And but thankfully, we have people who nominate good software so that people, you know, you can see from just a simple, small list, these are the things which people actually care about at the moment. So I think that's pretty cool. Next category is Digital Forensics Blog of the Year. We have Volatility Labs blog. So tied in with the nomination for Volatility for Computer Forensics Software of the Year. And there's that I am fairly familiar with. And I have read that on a couple of occasions. We also have got Journey into Incident Response by Corey Harrell, and Corey's blog is pretty awesome, really. He covers quite a big range of material, and he's also into the whole volume shadow copy thing as well, which I also am a lot in favor of. And then there is one more nomination for that. Who was that?
I don't even know if we have to talk about it. Really, there's only two candidates that I see in that one.
Yeah, I mean, this one, Ken Pry. That name doesn't ring a bell to me. I don't know who it is.
It's like Christian Gajanananson.
I know. Someone was talking about Rob Lee the other day. I'm like, who's that? So Ken Pryor is the third person, or has the blog, which is nominated third for Digital Forensic Blog of the Year. And Ken... Ken's blog is somewhat different to the other two, I think, because the other two get very, very technical. Mm-hmm. And Ken does a good job of explaining some technical aspects of things, but without all of the numbers and the bytes and everything else. So not only is it good for digital forensic examiners to read, but it's also good for people who aren't that familiar with forensics as well. So, you know, full disclosure, Ken is good friend of ours, so you vote who you feel you want to vote for. Don't let us sway you or sway that one way or the other.
He'll sway you enough.
Yeah. Well, don't make him angry. You won't like him when he's angry.
No.
Phone Forensic Hardware of the Year. And here, once again, and it happens every year, we have the Cellbrite UFED, except it's not just the UFED this year, it's the UFED Touch. So Brian, you do a lot of work with Celb, right? So you wanna? I've only seen this thing.
Like, so the old version of Celebrite ran a very very how can I say this in a nice way? Old version of Windows and didn't quite have the speeds up to par with some of the acquisitions. The Touch actually runs, I believe it's USB 2 under the hood, or it runs USB 2, so the iOS collections are actually much, much faster. Plus, it supports a whole bunch more phones. I mean, it's, yes, on all, you know, everything aside, it's very, very expensive, but it's very, very robust. And I mean, you know, X-Ray in the category as well. All of them are, you know, good in their own way, but Celebrite, every year they seem to be, you know, have some kind of new phone thing, and this year, well, last year was their Touch, so hopefully for 2013, maybe they'll have, like, a super hologram projection or something like that. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I like about the UFED Touch, because I've not actually used it yet, I'm hoping to get my hands on one in the next week or so, is the fact that it brings in, like, the ability of the regular UFED as well as the physical analyzer software and puts it all kind of together. So you can get a full image of an iPhone 4, for example, when you're out in the field,
yeah,
which you would have to have taken a dongle and a laptop and everything else to do beforehand. Yeah. So I think that's really, really good. And when you look at that and you look at stuff like the Tableau TD3 and all this other stuff, which is coming out new, mm-hmm, you know, small devices with screens with operating systems on the device is what appears to be where the trend is at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also much easier, too. It's one power supply, and actually the UFED Touch can be battery operated. So, you know, you don't...
Oh, nice.
It's still, of course, you want to make sure that you have, you know, everything possible with you at all times, but you know, if you absolutely have to run out and grab an iPhone from somewhere, you know, you can do it completely just from one device and actually go and do some triage right there. So it's like I said, we're not trying to sway any votes, but it's pretty good.
And then you also mentioned that the XRY Field Edition has also been nominated there as well.
So. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to do anything with that, unfortunately. Pretty much my limitation on this one is the UFED Touch. That's the only experience that I've had with this category. And
now,
if it was up to me, I would have them all, but it's not up to me. So.
Now, I know the guys at Microsystemation, and they're, you know, for even when you take out the fact they're a Swedish-based company, you know, their products are really, really good. And this is basically... It appears to be their answer to the UFED Touch.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they both kind of do the same kind of things, and it's entirely down to preference as to which one you use, I imagine. But once again, it's not something I've had hands-on, any hands-on experience with. Projector phone, however, I do have hands-on experience with. And when I first... This is going to sound really, really bad. When I first saw these, I was like, really? You know, people actually buy stuff to do this? Have you ever seen one of these before, Brian?
I believe so. I need to look it up real quick to make sure I don't have that confused with something else that I've seen before.
Yeah, it's like a stand for a mobile phone, and then it has like a little arm which comes up,
yes,
and you affix,
yeah,
a camera to. And so... All it does is it makes sure you can take pictures of the screen accurately. I'm like, you know, why would anyone want to use one of these? But then, about 5 or 6 months ago, we got a phone in we needed to get the text messages from, and none of the things which we had would do it. You know, the Celebrite unit wouldn't do it, none of the software which we had, you know, numerous things we tried, we couldn't get these text messages. So I was left to take pictures with a camera of every single text message on this phone. And I tell you, after about 2.5 hours, I felt like my arms were going to drop off. So, you know, projector phone may seem a bit silly when you first see it, but in reality, you know, it's probably going to save save your arms. Quite a bit of aching and pain over a couple of days.
He probably could have used a paperclip and the camera. And
stop it. Stop it. Yes, people did try to nominate the paperclip for phone forensic hardware of the year, and it was smacked down immediately. No, no, no. Not going to happen. Still buy awards. I can still ban people if I feel like it. Okay. Digital Forensics Book of the Year. And this is where I'm going to struggle a little bit because I'm going to be completely honest. I don't know very much about any of these three particular nominees. I don't know if you have any experience with them or...
Well, so the first one is Malware Forensic Field Guide by Malin Casey and Aquilina, I believe his name is. I've seen the name 100 times. I actually, it's like Kristen. I have no idea how to pronounce it. This is kind of more of it's a practical guide for malware analysis. Actually, kind of like it says, like performing it in the field. Whereas the second nomination, which is Practical Malware Analysis, kind of breaks down fully the malware, you know, malware analysis, reverse engineering, essentially from start to finish. So it's kind of, you know, one is kind of the, like, long, in-depth, sort of college-level course, and the other one is the quick and dirty, like, here's how to do it when you absolutely have to do something. The third book, which is The Basics of Digital Forensics, I have to admit, I have no experience with. I don't think that I have that on my shelf of books to read, so I should probably add it. Obviously, enough people have deemed it worthy enough to read, so I probably should have it, but unfortunately I don't.
Yeah, I think that's it's a Syngress publication, is it?
Okay.
I believe so. I think that's what they were saying on Twitter the other day. But, yeah, I mean, I think you're quite familiar with Owen Casey, aren't you? So, anything that Owen Casey is involved in is going to be good. I mean, there's no question. And I believe that James Aquilina, isn't he... I believe he works for Strauss, doesn't he?
I think I'm pretty sure he used to. I'm not sure if he still does.
Okay. But I mean, good people writing that.
Yes.
Like I said, all I can say is what I know about the people. I don't know anything about the books at the moment. You know, if people want me to know more about these, they should send me them, and I can read them, and then I can give an honest opinion. Same with all the hardware. Send me hardware. Yes. I'll have a look at it.
Please.
You know, it's great. I promise it'll get rigorously tested. So, on to Computer Forensic Hardware of the Year. And in amongst this, you were just saying beforehand, Brian, how there's two entries from Tableau here. Yeah, I mean, we've got the TD3 in there, which, you know, I'm not going to make any recommendations of anything here, but if I had $3,000 to drop on some hardware, this would probably be the hardware that I was going to purchase, to be perfectly honest, because it's pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm.
It does... This is going to really sound like an advertisement, and I'm so sorry. But it does the regular stuff which the TD1 and TD2 did, where it'll do... you know, drive-to-drive acquisition, but it won't just do it regular acquisition. It'll do the encrypted EXO1 file format now. It does USB write blocking. It does network write blocking. It also allows you to acquire on the unit straight to a network share. It's got all kinds of really, really good, really, really excellent features. So... I would certainly recommend at least trying it out and finding some reviews of that before if you're thinking about buying it. The UltraDoc 5, I don't really know much about, unfortunately.
I believe that was the first write blocker that actually had USB 3 capability. So it has had eSATA, had FireWire 800, I believe. I don't think it had 4. It might have had an adapter for 400, and also had the USB 3. And It's made by Weebitech, and if memory serves, it was like $269 or so. So it's quite a bit cheaper.
Good.
Yeah, it's quite a bit cheaper than the Tableau offerings. And then the third entry in the field is the T35U, which is Tableau's USB 3 write blocker, but that only does it does USB 3/USB 2, but there's no other connections that one supports. So, I mean, I know my nominee for that one already personally, but yeah, I was kind of surprised that there were two Tableau entries for Computer Forensic Hardware of the Year. But once again, they're always in there. So
yeah, and sounds like Tom's joining us or trying to.
No, I'm here. Sorry, I'm late.
No problems. So I just want to clarify with what you said. So for Tableau T35U. That's the output, which is USB 3, not just the input, right?
Oh, yes.
So it still takes in SATA and IDE drives, but
it's basically the T35ES, but it's USB 3 instead of eSATA, FireWire, and USB 2.
Cool. If they've taken all those ports off, it should be cheaper then, right?
One would hope.
Yeah. Actually, one of my students picked up the UltraDock 5, and she really likes it so far.
Awesome. Yeah, Brian was just saying how it's fairly inexpensive as well, so that's always a plus.
I have the UltraDock 4, and it's relatively good. I've been eyeing the 5, but I don't know if I'm going to get the 5 or wait and get the Tableau.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as if you could buy probably 11 UltraDock 5s for the price of a TD3, so...
I'm not having very much luck with TD series right now, so don't get me started on that.
Oh, you know, we have our TD1 in the office, and I love the TD1. I made sure that we bought one when I was working at Disk Labs. We have one at the office now. And just the last couple of weeks, I've started to have some problems with it, so we're going to send it back for repair.
Yeah, we have a TD2, which is nice because it has the... You know, that you can do a single source to two destinations.
Yeah.
I don't like the fact that they changed the adapters because the cabling they're using now is kind of rigid.
Yeah.
So it's very hard when you're working on a small table space to set up two drives with these stiffer cables and not have the drives falling off the table.
Hmm. Yeah. So just as we're sidetracking, we'll talk about this anyway. Apparently. I had no idea about this until someone at work told me. But the TD1 has got the Molex power connector on. The TD2, they changed it to like a proprietary connection, didn't they?
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know. My cynical view of that was they've done that on purpose to make people buy these cables, which only they produce, so it's going to cost more, and so on and so forth. But this person at work, his name is Kevin. He pointed out that Molex connectors are only supposed to be used like only a couple of hundred times before they're considered to be worn out and no longer useful. So,
you mean unplugged and plugged back in?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So I had no idea about that, and he brought up this paper, showed me about it and stuff. So yeah, so once again, my cynicism shot down in flames, unfortunately. So.
Well, I mean, the connectors are nice, and it's just the... And again, I don't know what they're doing with the cabling, but it's a stiffer cable, so there's not a lot of flexibility like you have with the standard Molex and the standard even SATA cables, because they're also attached. So there's just a difference you notice, because I've used the TD1 before in a previous life, and it was easier to... kind of have the unit in the center and have the drives there, and if you need to kind of turn them a little bit or twist them and flip them upside down just so you can get the connectors on, you know, it wasn't that hard to do it. Now you can do that, but then you start worrying about, I've literally seen it start to kind of turn the drive if you have it bent at an angle or something like that, where I get kind of panicked about the drive falling off the table.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable.
Maybe you should have some paper clips there to hold the drives in place.
Stop it. Just knock it off.
Oh, if I do that, I can put it in as a nomination next year.
Exactly.
Stop it. No.
And by the way, I want to point out one fact fact about that, that I think Apple would disagree that the paperclip has not evolved, because if you notice the SIM removal tool that they use with the iPhones, it looks like it's a newer generation of the paperclip in terms of how it's formed.
But it's not a paperclip, therefore...
But how do you know it wasn't a paperclip before it started?
Shut up. Okay, moving on. Phone Forensic Software of the Year. And for this we have Cellbrite Physical Analyzer, which we kind of touched on already a little bit. But Brian, do you want to talk a little bit about that again?
That's mainly the software component of the Cellbrite. Pretty much, it used to be required that it was on a separate desktop. Now with the touch, it actually has some of the functionality on the touch. It's essentially that is what allows you to read the data. The one thing that I like about Cellbrite compared to some of the other tools, none of them that are actually nominated here, is that they will actually import pretty much anything. So if you have an iPhone image that you made, you know, back in the day when you used to image it over Wi-Fi, you can import that into the Cellbrite Physical Analyzer, and it will go through and parse that just like the normal chain, as if it was acquired by one of the Cellbrite devices itself. I mean, it's once again, it's a really, really robust tool. Allows you to do a lot of things. Same thing with X-ray. Their software component allows you to parse out data from a bunch of different devices. WhatsApp Extract, I personally have never used. I'm guessing that pulls out the data from some of the WhatsApp applications, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I believe so. It's supposed to. Let me see. I'm just gonna try and find someone who put in for that.
While you're looking, I'm curious, Brian, with, and maybe Lee, if you've used it too. So with the Cellbrite, have you had any issues with the just getting the dongle recognized with the physical analyzer?
Not from transferring the when I used to transfer the license from the hardened hardware, the old Cellbrite hardware piece. Mm-hmm. Transferring the license from the USB over to the device was never an issue. I know that there are some times that for whatever reason when they do the dongle, just strictly the dongle-based version, just certain computers just don't recognize it. I don't know exactly why that is.
Because we have the Cellbrite, the old, not the touch, the older one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we bought the physical analyzer too, and I've had the worst, that's probably the one USB dongle I have that has always been the most problematic one I've ever run into. I've had it in three different machines. I've had it work in one machine, and I go back like a month later to use it again, and I have to start fidgeting with it again just to get it recognized. And it's really weird how that particular, and even putting it in like a USB hub, you know, I have an X-Ways dongle in there and IEF in there and a couple other dongles and a hub that's plugged in the computer. I plug that in, and it's like it doesn't exist. I was just curious on your opinion on that, because I've actually had a lot of issues with Cellbrite in terms of just getting it working a lot of times. So it's been
I understand the reasoning behind the dongle, but I think personally I would just take the license from the machine and just put that on the computer, and then when you're done using it, if you're not going to use that computer again, just take the license off. I mean, it only takes a couple of seconds to do. And okay. Honestly, if you're having problems with the dongle, like I said, we had some problems initially with one of the dongles that we had, and we just ended up doing the same thing. We would just take one of the keys, or one of the licenses from the device, put it on the computer. When we're done with the computer, we'd just pull it off of there. And they're actually really good too. If you end up losing one of the licenses, like through some inadvertent thing, like the device powers off halfway through or something, they're pretty good about replacing the licenses as well.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Cool stuff. So I found someone talking about the WhatsApp thing, and they're saying that it's an open source tool to parse WhatsApp chat data extracted from the iPhone and from Android devices. So that's cool. I mean, out of the three, it's the only one which doesn't cost any money. And, you know, WhatsApp, it's gaining some notoriety. It appears, I just read a news article today saying that Google appeared to be interested in purchasing the app. So there's got to be something in this. So, personally, once again, I haven't tried this, but I encourage you to go try it out and then make an informed decision when you vote. So, nothing at all like making informed decisions when voting for your president, obviously. Oh, sorry. Did I say that? moving on. So, Digital Forensic Article of the Year. Here we have three very strong contenders for this. We have Instant Response with NTFS, INDX Buffers, Ham, and Bellenthin, I think is how you pronounce his name. I don't know. Then we have the NTFS Triforce, A Deeper Look Inside the Artifacts by Dave Cowan. And then Leveraging the Application Compatibility Cache in Forensic Examinations by Davis. So I don't know if you guys have had any familiarity reading any of these particular three. I've certainly read the second one. Dave Cowan lives just, I don't know, a couple of miles from me, so I see him.
I think I can see him from your, through your window, so.
Was he waving?
Yeah.
He's going to come on the podcast at some point, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've read the first two. The first one, it's been a while since I read it. The third one, it sounds familiar, but I probably have to go back and look at it. You know, I mean, if there were links to the actual pages where the blogs were posted, you know, I could probably look at that. But since that information doesn't appear to be up here at the moment, you know.
That's my nomination for 2013, hyperlinks. That's going to be the tool of the year.
Hyperlink. All right. You know, everyone's lucky that I got this done at all. Thank you very much. Good grief. Everyone, honestly, try your best and everyone just tries to pull you down.
Come on, we gotta give you grief on something.
Yeah, I don't know. It's because I'm so good at everything else.
I knew that I was awesome was intentionally in there.
No. David Cowan is going to be talking on this particular subject at the SANS Forensic Summit in July in Austin as well. And the tools that he and his team have produced that are very, very, very useful indeed for going back, finding what happened to data, you know, how it was deleted, when it was deleted, stuff which you ordinarily wouldn't be able to find. They've done an excellent job in putting together and being able to put down, you know, give you basically a timeline of events for specific files. Definitely go read this, test out his tools as well because they're very, very good. Digital Forensic Organization of the Year, and you'll notice that for the first time ever, the organization was spelt with a Z. Or is it?
Properly, you mean.
Right. Okay, so I put out a question a couple of weeks ago. Okay. How come, you smartass, that if organization is spelt with a Z, how come advertise, an advertisement, is all still spelt with an S? An advertising.
Probably has something to do with a silent Q somewhere in there. I guess.
All right, so Digital Forensic Organization of the Year, Volatility Team. Obviously, we already talked about Volatility, the software, and the Volatility blog. And it's Andrew Case, isn't it, who's behind that, I think.
No, it's not all of them. It's MHL, it's Jamie Aaron, of course, and Andrew as well.
I think Andrew.
There's more. I mean, there's probably six or seven people. Okay. That's the core part of that team.
Yeah.
I think the only reason I knew Andrew Cates was because he appears to be the most vocal of them whenever writing blogs and stuff like that. So, but once again, you know, they have the blog, they have the software, that they've done some excellent work. So that's why they've been nominated. The Verizon Risk Team. Now, this was nominated by a few people, including Kyle Maxwell,
who works for
the Verizon Risk Team.
I didn't know you could do that.
Right, so the rules are you can nominate yourself or the company you work for, but you're not allowed to vote for the company or whatever that you work for.
I don't read the small print ever, so.
No, I should probably get around to putting that down somewhere. That's just like a verbal rule, which I'm... there's so much to do, though. It's just... Anyway, they've published some good stuff this year as well. And they also were the ones who released that story we talked about in the last episode where the guy was...
The VPN to China?
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
Outsourcing all his work to China from 5 or 6 different jobs. Awesome. And since then, I've started to do that, which is why none of this has been done properly.
Why you have all the free time now.
Yeah. Party. Woo. All the free time to sit and make magazines and stuff. And then finally we have Mandiant as well, who once again, same as the other two, they work very, very hard. They put out some good tools and good software, which are very, very helpful. And also their report, which they put out on an annual basis, is also very, very useful reading, especially if you do instant response for your own company or anything like that. Then... Any more to say on that, guys?
I think that covers it.
Then finally, we come to Digital Forensic Examiner of the Year. And for this, we have... we have two females and one male in there. So we have Andrew Case, Alyssa Torres, and Heather Mahalik. So, Andrew, it's been a running theme. You know, he's part of the Volatility Team. Does some excellent work. Alyssa Torres, she recently became a certified SANS instructor teaching the 508 class. She, you know her pretty well, don't you, Brian?
Yeah. She teaches 526, I think, the new memory class, too.
She just started teaching that one.
That's awesome. She's really, really... she's an excellent presenter as well. Mm-hmm. Anybody who was able to get in to see her presentation at the SANS Summit last year will agree. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get in. There weren't enough seats. So, we just had to go hang out for a little while.
That's exactly what we did, too. We just hung out.
we weren't good enough to get in.
No, we weren't.
And then Brian was drunk as well, and he was throwing things at people.
Well, of course. It was a day that ended in Y. Of course I was.
And then Heather Mahalik. I don't know who Heather is, unfortunately.
She does the SANS mobile class.
Ah, gotcha. Very cool. All right, so I will endeavor to get everything written up and typed up into blog posts so people can read about each of these people and tools and organizations individually, and then you guys can make your informed decisions. And if you want to post your votes, go to forensicforecast.com, and you'll see at the very top of the page, just underneath the logo, you'll see a section for Forensic Forecast Awards. Just click on that, and it'll pop up a screen for you to go and enter your information about who you want to vote for. So please go ahead and do that. So that's the awards.
Hey, Lee, I heard there's a rumor that there's a Lifetime Achievement Award going to Ovi Carroll. Is that true?
Right. You know... Whenever someone finishes a podcast episode with "suck it, Lee," I'm just inclined to give them any kind of award. Yes, you know. I thought, you know, Ovi, we had a good time together last year whenever we were in Orlando teaching that class together. And you just kind of... You ruined that now.
He doesn't call, he doesn't write.
You know, it's so depressing. You put in all... You know, it's such a one-sided relationship, you know. It's... It really is quite sad what happened there.
You must be too clingy there, Lee.
You know, I just said before that Alicia made me take the picture down because she thought it was a bit too scary. So, anyway. Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, after the last episode that we put out, Brian emailed me with a cool little story that I want to take some time to discuss because this is really, really useful for us as forensic investigators, but it's also very, very useful for people who are not familiar with computers and, you know, how people can put themselves not just at risk of having their information stolen, but, like, ruining their lives. I mean, there's some really, really bad stuff out there. So, Brian, do you want to just tell us a little bit about the article that you sent over?
It was originally posted by Kyle Maxwell of apparently Verizon Risk fame. Little shout out there. And it primarily talked about the title of the article. It was on Ars Technica, and the title of the article was "Meet the Men Who Spy on Women Through Their Webcams," and it was the subtitle was "The Remote Administration Tool is the Revolver of the Internet's Wild Wild West." So it's pretty much just going through a bunch of the details regarding some of the remote access Trojans that are out there, remote access tools that are out there that will essentially allow people to not only just, you know, siphon data off the computer, but actually get to the point where you turn on the webcams, you know, take pictures and, you know, do all sorts of things with that. And it was really interesting because it takes the whole aspect from, you know, what we commonly see is, you know, a financial data breach, you know, X amount of personal information was stolen, and just goes into the whole kind of criminal stalking, preying aspect of it and say, hey, you know, not only can we do all this stuff, but we can just turn on the webcam and take pictures, and, you know, whatever people do in front of their computers is entirely up to them. But it was just kind of a little more eye-opening than I personally thought it would be. Just, you know, like, not necessarily paranoid, but it's like, what if that webcam's really on and that light isn't on, and who's actually watching me? And then more importantly, who would really want to watch somebody like me? So it was very interesting, to say the least.
I very much agree with that last comment.
They just see lots of drinking.
Yeah, so this is really... I read something. I don't know if any of you guys read the Security Monkey blog at all. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Security Monkey?
Yeah. This guy...
We have many monkeys in our field. You know that?
Yeah, we do have a lot of monkeys.
Yeah, we do.
That probably says something.
I can't possibly comment. But... Yeah, this guy posted something a while ago. He's been blogging for long before forensic blogging was even, you know, a thing. And he got an email from this girl, and it's not the exact same as this, but it's similar. He got this email from this girl saying that, you know, one of my friends knows about you, asked me to get in touch because this is what's happened to me. And she went through the story that she's never given her name and password out to anybody, or a phone number, or anything like that. And yet, somehow, she's like early 20s, you know, going to college, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, on her iPhone, she had some of those pictures, which, you know, young early 20 females to take, and what happened is that they ended up going on the internet, and not just going on the internet, but being posted to people who know her and it was basically it screwed up her life. I mean, she asked if there was a way that she could get these taken down, and you know, everyone knows as soon as that stuff hits the web, you lose complete control of it. So he went through and he's like, "This is what I think happened." I look at like your Facebook account, and I can, because it's open and I don't have to be friends with you in order to see the information on there, I can basically go through and I can see all of the things you ever posted. You have security questions like, what type of car do I have? What's my dog's name? And so once people get access to those, they can answer these security questions for your email and everything else. They then can go in and they can send password requests to stuff like iCloud. They will then get that information back, and then they'll use something a bit like the Elcomsoft password software, which connects directly to iCloud and pulls down iCloud accounts, including the pictures which you've taken on your phone, at which point they can be distributed online. So we talked a bit about two-factor authentication in the last episode and about how I'm a slacker for not using it. So I just want to point out now that I've turned it on for everything that I have. Why is that funny?
No reason.
Oh, okay. Right.
There's a definitive decline in the amount of naked Lee pictures that are out there, so that explains the reasoning behind that.
Once again, I don't really know what to say to that. All I can say is I'm sorry.
Old research.
Even if they didn't exist, I'm sure someone would be photoshopping them anyway, so what does it matter? And the photoshops, in fairness, would look better. So, just average people getting targeted by stuff like this. And the article which you mentioned, Brian, talks specifically about Dark Comet, which is, you know, it's the new Trojan, which, you know, I mean, Sub-7 existed years ago, but this is like essentially like the new version of Sub-7. And allows people direct access to machines, you know. But what do we do about, for example, have got four children. I know they're going to grow up knowing what I do for a living. They're going to grow up having a very good understanding of what they should and shouldn't be doing online and who they should be giving information to, what information should be posting and everything else. But how do you get that message across to normal users? I mean, even just people in general that you meet every day. Why? Who's going to teach them this stuff?
Well, I think it needs to be kind of the sort of when we were in school, you know, like we had McGruff the crime dog, and he'd do his little puppet talking and say, you know, hey, you know, if you see something, tell the cops. And Smokey the Bear, like, you know, and one match can start a forest fire. Like, there needs to be some sort of, I hate the word, but some sort of cyberish initiative, you know, to actually get people to start thinking about this stuff. And honestly, it could be a talking paperclip. Microsoft already has one. It would be awesome. Once again, just throwing it out there. But there really needs to be something to that effect, because it's otherwise, it's just going to be, you know, just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And you're going to be like, oh, well, I didn't know you could do this. Like, it all comes down to just a little bit of education. And honestly, I think something like that needs to happen much sooner rather than later.
Yeah. One of the things which I think about as well is that, when I went through and turned on the two-factor authentication for everything, I found that some things, it was really easy to find that information. Like, if I turn it off my Google Mail, it was just, it was a switch. And then I can go through and I can figure out, you know, I download an app from my phone, fine, no problem. But for Facebook, for example, in trying to find how to turn on two-factor authentication, was an absolute pain in the neck.
Well, I think you have to buy their new phone in order to turn it on, right? Which automatically siphons all the data back to Facebook. Isn't that how that works?
Yeah. I guess once your stuff hits Facebook as well, you're pretty much SOL. So, they own it, so they can do whatever they want with it. But, yeah, I mean, some things, even if you want to be secure, it takes a lot of effort to do that. And this stuff, it needs to be seamless. Otherwise, people just aren't going to adopt it.
Yeah. Well, but that's always been the issue. You know, that's been the biggest complaint about security since, you know, it was started, is that it's very difficult to implement, you know, for people that are not security-minded. You know, all of us and, you know, people that work in this field know that understanding because we deal with it every day. But it's the reality is the people outside of our little circle have no clue because it's not part of what they do, you know. But in the same sentence, that a lot of times you have people that are just like, you know, I just want this device to work, and all the security is doing is making things take longer, or it's causing problems, or I'm getting errors, and I don't understand it, and forget it, I'm just going to put it back the way it is.
Yeah. But then, if this is what we know, what we do, is the onus on us to go out and to tell people that this is, you know, these are the dangers, and this is what you should be doing?
We can certainly tell them, but again, it's going to be up to them to either understand what the impact is and take some action on it, or they won't do anything, and then when suddenly something happens, like their identity stolen or something to that effect, then all of a sudden the awareness is there. But that's the way it is with everything. I mean, you see that with corporations, with, you know, how they don't want to put the money into security and things like that, and then all of a sudden they get this breach and all their data sitting out into the internet, and then, oh, you know what, I think we're going to start implementing a security plan, and we're going to hire all these people on and help us out, and da-da-da-da. You know, it's going to be a revolving door, and it's just going to be new technologies that come along. I mean, perfect example is Google Glass. The impacts of that being rolled out are just so unforeseen right now, and people are in a panic where you have, you know, bars kind of putting up and saying, you know what, no Google Glass allowed in here. But you start getting that into the environment, so to speak, and it's a whole new era of social integration, for lack of a better word. You know, you're talking about basically having a video camera on your head that is, there's no real indication whether or not it's on or not, and everybody and anything that you're around is going to be recorded.
Yeah, but is that the same kind of thing, though? I mean, so you're someone is overtly record. I mean, obviously, you said, like you said, there's no real way of knowing whether or not they are, but you have to just assume that they're overtly recording everything. You know, that they're recording the conversations that you have, and anything that you're doing, you just have to assume is being watched and recorded by someone. I mean, it's not a huge leap away from the from having CCTV cameras on the corner of every street. You know, it's just the next natural progression in terms of this is what people are going to share. You know,
but you're not going to have a CCTV in a college party in a frat house where there's a keg of beer and everyone's getting, you know, silly, and you got somebody walking in there with the Google Glass on and they're recording everything.
Yeah, but well, they still have their phones. I mean,
yes, but a phone, it's obvious what you're doing because you have to put the phone up in front of somebody's face. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, in the drunken stupor, they're not going to care what you do and they're going to end up taking the picture anyway and probably pose for it. But, you know, it's...
No. Yeah. I, for one, will be purchasing Google Glass at the earliest opportunity.
Oh, I'm not saying I'm you know, geeked out about it, but it's going to be more interesting to see the social implications of something like that, because you're almost to the point now where you're throwing privacy out the window.
Yeah, but then you also tie this in with what Brian was saying earlier, is that how do you know that, you know, I mean, if you're wearing Google Glass, how do you know that you're the only person who's seeing, or the intended recipients? The only people are seeing what you're seeing at that particular moment. There's so much potential for abuse from evildoers here. You know, they can see everything that you're doing on a daily basis, even to the point where, you know, if they see that, you know, they somehow get into this device. They can see you're out at a park somewhere with your kids, and they come by and they can burgle your home while you're out.
I think the point of entry is going to be how the Google Glass communicates, because my understanding is it's supposed to tie into your phone, and that's the data connection. And it's, I'm assuming, going to use Bluetooth. So right there, you have your point of entry.
That's, yeah.
But until it's actually out, who knows?
Well, we'll find out whenever it hits, I'm sure.
Later this year.
Yeah. I'd like to say that I want to own one for research purposes so I could do some forensic report on it or presentation. Mm-hmm. That's just not the case.
That's why I got a Chromebook. I was one of the people who got selected for that CR48 thing, and it's pretty good. Yeah, I've had it for probably 3.5 years now, and I don't think I've really got into it that far at all. So it's pretty good.
One of the things which I've tried to do recently, just going back to putting the onus on us as investigators, is I've sent emails out to my kid's principal and to the school district and to youth groups in the area and stuff like that, just saying, look, this is what I do for a living. This is the kind of stuff that I've seen. This is the kind of stuff I hear about on a daily basis. I think it'd be very, very useful to have me come in and to give a presentation to the kids and the parents about best practices when going on using the internet. So I don't know if that's something which everyone's going to be comfortable with, but there must be ways which we can get out and help people to protect themselves.
Yeah, I think just pointing out the stories like that, the link that they sent with regards to the naked pictures online with this story with, the spying on the webcam, like just publicizing stuff like that more, I think is kind of the first step in that direction. But there absolutely needs to be some kind of I don't want to say it's not mandatory education, but there needs to be some kind of, general public awareness, like a keep calm and turn off your webcam or something like that. Just something needs to be out there, and it needs to start, like I said, it definitely needs to start soon. It should have already started, and I don't think that it has, but stuff like that is just, it's borderline scary, because it's only a matter of time before actual honest to God, abductions, crimes all happen, all because of it's essentially stuff like this.
Yeah.
And what can you say? I heard that people could spy on you through your webcam, or, I heard that people could, put something malicious on a phone and track where you were, but I never thought it would happen to me. Well, it already has. I mean, that's already happened. So we just need to, try to figure out some way to make less of a push on, attributing it to a certain computer terminal in China, and more of a general U.S.-based education on, here's some of the dangers that can be had by doing stuff like this. And I'll step down off my soapbox, I'm sorry.
I think the issue that, again, you're still going to run into is it'll work for a time and then it'll be forgotten. Because, yep. I mean, we've had email for how long now, and how many people are still clicking on links and getting their machines infected?
I do it purposely.
But you do it for research purposes.
Yeah.
But I think, in all honesty, I do think there's more of an awareness now than there was, even say 2 or 3 years ago, in terms of, I probably have more people come up to me when they, depending on who tells them what I do, it's either always into computers or, he finds things on computers or something like that. And you start getting those kinds of questions in terms of, can they really do this or can they really do that? And depending on what the actual question is, is it, can they actually, remote into my machine and drive my car and lock all my doors and keep me in the house just from touching my phone? So I think the proliferation of both, one, social media, two, computer penetration in homes and so forth has at least increased the awareness a little bit more. But again, I kind of agree with Brian. I don't think we're there yet. Whether or not we should be or not, you know, as a society, the stuff that we should be concerned about, we're always kind of behind on.
Yeah. So we just bought an excellent home security package. Okay. So this thing is like, does everything you can think of. Ties in with our current alarm system, but then we also get like a camera which we can monitor from our phones, and we can lock and unlock the door remotely from our phone, even change like the temperature. We can set our air conditioning to whatever we want remotely. So, you know, we spend all this money on physical security for ourselves. But I just think that maybe people just don't take cyber security as seriously as physical security. Now, I don't know if people not being educated enough, or if it's just not, you know, if people just don't care about it in the same way. You know, if someone breaks into your house, it's a very, very real threat because the person's there. If someone breaks into your computer, you may never know that because you may never see the consequences. But it's still a very, very real threat.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a combination of that. I mean, it's just like everything else. Like, nobody really reacts or kind of makes any progress towards actually fixing something until something horrible happens to them. You know, people won't have a security system for their house until their house gets broken into. People won't try to take steps to, you know, do something to protect themselves online until something happens to them. For the most part, it's a lot harder for people to actually say, hey, you know, somebody got into my computer, stole all my financial stuff, got into my bank account, until the bank account is at zero. Like, if you just take, you know, a couple, you know, a dime a day or something like that, most people aren't going to recognize something like that. You know, or like if your social security number gets out there and is being sold on the Russian card hacker forums or, you know, whatever down that road, like, most people don't know about that, the stuff like that. And that's honestly where most of it is. So until they actually are able to be aware of that, and usually when they're aware of it is when something terrible happens that, you know, their $175,000 in the bank that was going towards a retirement is gone, their house is, you know, repossessed because the mortgage check bounced for 3 months in a row and the bank didn't tell them, you know, all of that stuff, until it happens to them, they're not going to actually really do anything about it.
It's certainly tricky. I really do think that we've got that responsibility to people who know about it to try and let other people know. So I'm really, really interested in this. And like I said, I'm trying to do stuff for it. But if anyone's got any other ideas on what you can do in this regard, I'd really like to entertain those ideas and see what we can do about it, because I think this is something which really needs to be addressed. So
now, Lee, I'm curious, the contacts you said that you put out to the different groups and stuff, did you initiate those, or was there a reason that you sent those out?
Yeah, so it started off because Kaylee, my oldest, she was in the computer class, and the computer teacher, she said something about not giving out any detail, not giving a name and vital details to people on the internet. And so I thought that's really, really good. I'm glad that some schools are taking that approach. So I wrote a letter to them and said, I'm grateful for you telling my kids this, but I think there's a lot more to say which hasn't yet been said. So, yeah, I instigated that based on what happened with Kaylee. So, I guess I should also point out that's been somewhat received by people, but a lot of people still don't want anything to do with it. So, like I said, I'm open to to a lot more suggestions as to how we accomplish that.
Well, again, it's like anything else. Until there's some major incident that compromises a lot of people, it's going to be lower on the totem pole.
So what we should do is target people who own PlayStations. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not trying to hint at anything specific we should be doing.
Alright. Fun stuff. Okay.
If only I had an army of paperclips.
Yep. You're going to get the Ovi face again. Alright. You guys got anything else you would like to talk about this evening?
Is there anything out there that can do physical images of the newer iPhone operating systems and the newer iPhone devices?
Not unless it's jailbroken.
I suspect that as soon as iOS 7 hits and the iPhone 5S hits, that we'll see some stuff appear.
Well, it's not even iOS anymore, though. It's the physical hardware. It's the chips that they're using. Yeah. I mean, they've, you know, as much as I despise everything that Apple put out pretty much until the 4S, like, they finally listened to the whole security thing and need to quit hiding behind the, oh, Macs never get viruses, because, they most certainly do. They really stepped their game up big time with security. Now, unfortunately, where they are at is pretty much where everybody else was at about 2.5 years ago, but still, I mean, you know, it is still progress, and iOS, you know, has all kinds of holes in it, but, you know, the physical hardware itself, it's gotten really, really good.
Yeah, I'm looking for a compliment to our Celebrite, and I contacted a friend of mine about the Access Data MPE, and I know there's the XRY out there, but I'm just trying to fill the gaps in terms of, you know, the devices we have in our environment and what we can do and what we can't do with them.
I have no idea, unfortunately. And I would say, if Brian doesn't know
about it, then... Personally, I would say if you have the legal authority, iCloud is still the way to go. I mean, their two-factor authentication is going to screw up some of the stuff. I haven't had a chance to test it yet. I haven't had a chance to test the Elcom soft tool with pulling back data from a two-factor authenticated account. But, I mean, you know, if we get a phone that's pin locked and passcode protected and everything, like, if they were really, really bad and had some kind of easy password on their iCloud account and I have the legal authority to do it, I'm going and getting all that data. And, you know, it syncs pretty regularly. I mean, in many cases, it's, you know, the stuff that's on the phone that day. So, you know, iCloud is still the way to go if once again you have the legal authority to get it.
Yeah. But isn't that the same as just getting a logical extraction of the phone in the first place, though?
It is, but that's the thing. Like, if the phone is pin locked, you know, there's really no way to bypass it anymore. So all if they use, you know, joe@hotmail.com and their password was password, I have all the data on their phone. So, you know, once again.
Is the iCloud, because I haven't used an iPhone in a couple of years, is the iCloud syncing everything now, or is it still just doing contacts, calendar, mail?
You can pick what it syncs. For the most part, all of the data across all of the devices will go back there, but usually it will be the stuff like the contacts, the address book, notes, calendar, SMS, pictures, yes, stuff like that.
Okay.
So you're still going to be missing stuff like email unless they're using the specific Mac email account.
Yeah,
email's typically not as much of an issue because it's, you know, from where I'm concerned, it's the corporate account.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rest of it because, you know, there's a device that we issue from an iPhone perspective, and then, of course, there's the people that buy their own and then, you know, use it on our corporate network, and then they have to have the newest ones. So,
yes.
just get it on your Wi-Fi network and try to try to SSH into it with the Alpine password and see if it works. And if it works, you know, it's jailbroken and you're good to go. You can get whatever you want. Did I say too much there?
No.
But make sure you have the appropriate authority.
Yes, yes. I am not a lawyer, and I don't think I've ever stayed a Holiday Inn Express, so I have no idea about any of that.
I've never been to bikinis. Okay. I don't have anything else really to mention. So, the only thing I've got is that at the end of the month, I will be in Toronto teaching the SANS 408 Windows in Depth Computer Forensics class. So if you're even semi-local to that and want to take that class, then that'd be a good opportunity to go along and to learn some cool stuff there.
So, sorry to interrupt. Are you teaching that solo now, or are you teaching with someone?
I'm teaching that one solo. And then I've got one in Dallas in September as well, but there's no page up for that yet. I wrote about this on the blog the other day on the Forensic Podcast website, so please feel free to go on there. There's a link on there so you can go onto the SANS site and see what material is going to be taught, see how much it is, and where to stay, all that kind of stuff. So feel free to do that. And I'll talk more about the one in September as the time draws closer.
Did you get a discount code for that yet?
I haven't received a discount code for that yet, no.
You need to get on that.
I'll find out.
So does this mean you're a SANS instructor now, or?
Not exactly, no. These are community SANS classes, so they're only the smaller classes. I'm hoping that after a few of these, I can move up into the dizzy realms of where O.V. Carroll teaches. So,
you start getting coffee for Rob and Hal and those guys and stuff like that.
I already did that last year. So.
Oh, okay.
Whenever Hal walks into the room, we usually just lay things on the floor, lay our jackets on the floor for him to walk across.
Well, he doesn't actually have to walk on them. He kind of just levitates up to the stage.
That's very true, yes. All right. Cool. All right, well, that's all I got for this week. Like I said, go on, vote for whoever you want to on the Forensic Forecast Awards. The voting will stay open until about the middle of, until the start of June for sure. I need time to get the awards engraved and stuff like that. So I'm probably going to say they're going to close on May 31st so we can get everything done on time. So go and get those votes in. And hopefully we'll get another one of these out fairly shortly. In the meantime, go check out Forensic Forecast magazine. It's I'm very proud of it. It's
Do you have any stats with how many times it's been downloaded/viewed?
I've only got how many times it's been downloaded. There's two ways you can look at this. There's one is the PDF you can just download straight from the website. And from that, I've had about 1,300 downloads for that so far. And then there's also like a Flash/HTML5 magazine view you can look at where it looks like you're actually flipping pages. And that one, I have no metrics for at all on that one at the moment. I'm trying to figure out how to get those. But yeah, it seems to be doing pretty good.
No, it looks good. I haven't read the whole thing yet. I think I've gotten past the cover, and that's about it.
Thanks. One of the interesting things, I just want to just touch on this briefly. One of the interesting things about this is that I've put like a forensics puzzle in the magazine, and the person who wins that will get a signed copy of David Cowan's new book. And they, you know, they'll also get recognized in the next issue and stuff like that. And it's a fun little contest to
which
try. Oh, you do have a camera. Oh, thank you very much for showing your face.
Hello.
You just didn't clean the house today or something. That's great.
No, I just figured I'd what save to begin with.
We all have them.
Yeah.
Come with us.
I have the Kindle version too.
I don't have it yet. Instead, I'm trying to buy this house.
Houses are overrated.
Thanks.
Yeah, really.
Put this over. It'll keep the rain out. You'll be fine.
Need a big book for me and my wife and four kids. Thank you very much.
He's going to use the extra copies of the magazine for that.
So, yeah, go on and try this contest. It's pretty cool. And I'm going to do
have
that.
Have you gotten any feedback on that yet?
Yeah. Brian's been playing with that. How about you, Brian?
It's a very, very good challenge. I will say the hardest part of it is actually trying to think like Lee. You know, everybody has to step down like four notches from where they normally are to try to think like Lee. So. No, but it is actually...
That's one, Brian. That's one.
That's one.
It's only
very,
one?
Very good challenge.
One left.
I can't believe I made it through two.
But, yeah, please go and try it, because I would really like some feedback about that. If people find it far too difficult, if people found it too easy, mm-hmm. I want to know, because I'm going to keep doing these in the future as well, so be happy to hear back about that. Let's see, was there anything else? I don't think so was. Okay, so cool. We can you can find Tom on Twitter at CDT Delta, and you can find Brian J Moran on Twitter as well. I am Lee _ Whitfield. You guys will find me at Forecast as well. So thanks for coming and checking out the show today. Don't forget, it's not just the audio anymore. You can also watch the show. You can watch it live if you felt like it. If, you know, stuff like your regular TV schedule allows you to watch stuff on a Sunday. Or, you know, it's not football season anymore. May as well spend your time doing something. Or you can watch it as a rerun on YouTube as well. So all of those options are available to you. I think that's about it for now. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.